This is a forum this evening which is entitled, Is Violence Necessary? A forum on the night of Soweto Day, the 16th of June. I'd never celebrated Soweto Day before, and when I heard it was going to be Soweto Day, I didn't really know what to expect. And I found that it was a very moving day from my point of view, partly because I was singing some of the freedom songs, and I find those to be very, very inspiring and exciting. Then we had a conversation this morning about the Kairos document, which came out of some theological reflection in South Africa, saying that Kairos now is the time. Kairos is a Greek word used in the New Testament, which Jesus uses when something significant is about to happen. It's the fullness of time. It's the time when something needs to happen, and if it doesn't happen now, the moment is lost and it can't happen again. The Kairos in this document, which we studied a moment this morning, is talking about a time when the churches need to take a stand in South Africa against the violence that's happening to their people and the ways in which people are dying. And then after that we saw a film. I don't know how many of you were able to see that just before lunch, about the kinds of violence that are happening, the violence that's happening in the states that are just north of South Africa, the way in which theory is and the actuality is that South Africa is keeping those countries destabilized. And it was beginning to come home to me that Soweto Day is celebrating the death of 700 children. Because there, when you see people dying, when you see people dead, you begin to think about 700 of them and think about the kind of brutality that causes that. You begin to think of the hopeful note that Barbara started out with this morning, saying that St. Olaf College, by writing letters, was able perhaps to change someone's mind and to get a clergyman released from prison who's now back in prison. Could we do something about it? A very important question to be asking. What is it that we need to do? This forum tonight is going to be a reflection on what it is that needs to be done in a time of violence, of suffering, of bloodshed, not just in Southern Africa, but we see this in many places around the world, too many to name actually, Ireland, Afghanistan, Middle East. And trying to come up with some way, some faithful response as Christian people, not just some kind of letter writing, but some kind of understanding of what we could do, what we would do in that kind of a situation, and how we can involve ourselves. And the question really boils down to is violence justified, or is violence necessary in order to bring justice? Is violence necessary in order to bring about justice? Some of you have answered this, and my parents answered this during World War II by saying that the evil of Nazism was great enough to require us to respond with military power. We find ourselves in a lot more ambiguous situations these days where the violence is more hidden, and we also find ourselves as inheritors of a couple of hopeful experiences, especially that of India gaining its freedom under Mohandas Gandhi in 48 through a nonviolent campaign with many successes, and also the civil rights movement in the United States in the 60s, which also had some incredible successes, and we are beginning to unearth and come to understand as white people what an incredible leader Martin Luther King Jr. was, and the brilliance of his faith and his hope as he led that campaign. What I'm hoping we can do tonight is listen to three people who sort of stand at three different places on a continuum of saying violence is not necessary, violence may be necessary, violence is necessary. And the three people are actually sort of just to my left here. Kate, what's your last name?
McDonald.
Kate McDonald, and Barry Shelley, and David Preisinger. And if you'd be willing to start, Kate, and just tell us a little bit about your response to this question, issue of violence, nonviolence, the context that you that you found yourself coming to your stand, and any other, maybe you could just give us a little bit of an introduction so that we know what you mean by nonviolence.
But first of all, I kind of feel like the new kid on the block. I just came yesterday. And when I admitted in some circle just that I was Catholic, they said, oh, there aren't many of them here. So I felt like a minority. And then I shared something that I was kind of risky to share. I said, I'm probably the only one here on probation, too, with a probation officer. And a couple of men laughed, and it was the truth. I'm on probation for doing civil disobedience in Minneapolis. Not knowing what kind of a crowd I'm talking to, have any of you ever, well, I'm sure you've been in demonstrations. Could I just see your hands if you've even been in a demonstration? Protest? And then could I see your hands if you have done civil disobedience? Totally alone then. I've been going to demonstrations against Minneapolis Honeywell for the last 10 years. And they've been demonstrating against Honeywell for about 20 years, I understand. And so I'm new in that. But my demonstrations were always there, always present, but never felt like I could take the action of civil disobedience. Not because I was against it, but just kind of a coward. That's for me now. I'm speaking for myself only. But in the last 12 years, I've been working at an elementary school where I'm teaching peace and justice to children, K through 8. And part of that, I make it personal in the sense of what I'm doing in the light of peace. And I make it very personal by sharing with them every time we have a demonstration, and I try to bring in the good things that Honeywell does, the good products that they make and the good peace products, and also to share that they are totally involved in military contracts with every kind of guidance system and the Trident and the MX and everything that's involved in weapon making, the cluster bomb, which is a real zinger. And so I try to offset that with the idea that they do make peaceful products and that we're out to talk to the CEOs to have them to peace conversion. So I have the children understand that we're not against the employees, and we know employees have to make a living for their children and everything. But what turns out is that two of the mothers of the two children that I take care of in the extended day program, two little kindergartners, work in Honeywell and work on the weapons systems. Mm-hmm. And to talk to those two women and see how beautiful and gentle they are, and then to see me taking care of their children and them working on a weapons system just kind of was mind-boggling for me. And I said to one of them one day, you seem like such a gentle woman. And I said, I'm just trying to figure out how you can concern yourself with something that the end is so destructive. And I'm just wondering how you reconcile that, because she was coming off as such a good Christian, I'm sure, and also so gentle. And she actually said, you just have to block it out. And to me, I just don't know how anybody can do that. And then I've met a young man that was an engineer for Honeywell and he read to us at one of our rallies his letter of resignation because of his conscience. He just had to quit there. Well, then I realized that I couldn't just step forward, and this gentleman that gave the talk last night here said, you know, to do something because you should or because you want to. I always felt like I should do civil disobedience to make a strong statement and be with the rest of them that are risking something and kind of being getting controversial. And then I thought, well, I can't do it unless I'm ready to make an articulate statement as to why I'm doing it. And I didn't feel like I was ready to articulate why and how and all that. And it just seemed like it took that many years for me to say, yes, I'm ready to make a real strong stand, and even to run the risk of being called naive, and to run the risk of saying this is a simplistic way to go about it. But it felt good to be counted with the number of people that stepped up and did the action of civil disobedience. And they were ranging from students from St. Olaf's and Carleton College, two good Lutheran colleges in Minnesota, to people my age and even older that had really not much to lose, because most of my life has been lived. And so we testified that we were doing it in the action for children. And I found that in teaching the children, they are so impressed by, you know, not only the words, but if you do something risky and something that kind of stands out, they will be impressed by that, I think. And some of them, I just left the school that I was teaching at, and it was after 12 years, so it was kind of like their grandmother leaving, and I just felt awful leaving. But I was going to a school where there's more minorities. My school kind of turned into almost an elitist school. The minorities were dropping off, and I felt real uncomfortable there. So when I was leaving, a lot of the kids wrote thank you notes for your, thank you for peace, and thank you for teaching us peace songs, and thank you for doing peace activities. And one kid said, thank you for stopping wars. The eighth graders were, I knew them as kindergartners, and they were telling me things that I said way back 8 years ago that still left an impression on them. And I thought, you know, it really makes a difference to talk about them being peace activists and peacemakers. And we have conflict resolution in our schools so that we just don't let a fight happen and let it end there and say, you go over there and you go over there. We try to have them resolve it. And it takes time and certainly a lot of energy, but it's working. They see themselves as having to resolve the conflict themselves. And I think that's kind of what was behind myself doing that. One of the best educators of peace, I think, that goes on is Pax Christi USA. And we have a very strong group in Minneapolis that put on something educational every year. And it seems that they are promoting peacemaking in this, with nonviolence. The people that do action against Minneapolis Honeywell are asked to go to nonviolent classes so that we don't react to the police in a way that's at all abrasive or indignant, or, you know, we're not there to get at the police, and they're certainly not there to antagonize us, it doesn't seem, but they do get, sometimes they get pushy, and I think you maybe know that Chief Boza is right there with his police force, and his wife is on our side doing the action of civil disobedience, and it's something to write about. And she's respected for that stand, and yet he knows, you know, that she's out there, and he's taken a little ridicule from that too, which I kind of have to admire the man. But the most outspoken person is a guy named Marv Davidoff, and the reason he speaks to me so, at least, is that he's actually a friend of all the police officers in Minneapolis. They wouldn't think of ridiculing his name or making fun of him or anything like that, because he's been so involved in peace demonstrations with the nonviolent approach that they actually respect that man, and he's very articulate, of course, as to what the danger of the weapons are doing. Another reason that I think my action takes a little makes an impact is I'm a very nonviolent person, and I'm also very non-threatening, I'm non-risk-taking. I kind of have that reputation, so that people that know me, and I've become kind of well known in Minneapolis and St. Paul because I've been around there for a number of years, and I have a number of people in my family. I belong to a religious community too, and three others in my family belong to it, so we've become known as being part of the peace action. And I think when you take a strong action, that might even put you in the workhouse for a weekend. People wonder why you would do that, and then they ask, and you have a chance to tell them how important it is to you and why a strong stand like that that's unpopular might make a difference to people. And that, you know, that we're not doing it for ourselves, especially at my age. And I've had a lot of my friends and my own family in the workhouse working off time. And this time, our action was taken, it was reduced to a petty misdemeanor. And you can't have a jury with that, so we can't make our testimony in front of an audience unless the courtroom is filled with other kind of offenders and we can say what we want to. But the judge was very respectful, and she gave us some, she wanted to fine us $30, and none of us took that. But she asked us if we wanted to do community service, and we took that. It was only 6 hours, and I'm working it off here at Holden Village.
Sentenced to Holden.
So I'm going to send, when I send my statement back, I'm going to send them a picture of this location and say, this is where I suffered.
Okay, so this is nonviolence as a sort of response to the problem of nuclear weaponry and manufacture and military buildup. So maybe we'll move to Barry and talk about some of the ideas you have about middle position.
I think I can keep this under 30 minutes. The whole question of the use of violence and social change has been something that I have struggled with and continue to struggle with for a long time. I can remember writing a paper in college entitled, I think it was something like, Is Violence Necessary? The exact title of this. And have been quite involved in political movements for some time, and have gone through all those nonviolent training things you're talking about, as well as having instructed on some. And have always been, and still remain, very committed to a nonviolent lifestyle, as well as a nonviolent political strategy, at least for North America. And my tendency would be to want to completely embrace, in absolute terms, a nonviolent position on social change and political strategy. That's what I'd really love. That would be a lot easier for me to do. However, I do have some problems with that. And there are several questions that continue to come back to me. And I guess I just want to briefly mention some of those, what I see as real points of grayness in the whole issue. First of all, I don't think that you can make a clear distinction between violence and nonviolence. Where do you draw the line between what is violent and what is nonviolent? Is it just simply the act itself, and one being aggressive and one not being aggressive? And I think that's probably the way that I would, and I think that is an important distinction to make. But very often, the effects of what may be thought of as nonviolent action can be as destructive, or at least destructive, of life and property also. I can remember in part of this paper I wrote in college reading some stuff out of Reinhold Niebuhr. Some of you may be familiar with the theologian. And his sort of critiquing Gandhi's strategy in India, and essentially being a great admirer of Gandhi and an admirer of the strategy he took in that particular situation, but also pointed out that the boycott of cotton by people in India from the cotton mills in England eventually led to starvation among children from parents who were working in Lancashire cotton mills. So where is that violent or is that nonviolent? And essentially it takes Gandhi a little bit to task for never really being willing to admit the moral compromises that he had to make. That Gandhi recognized the need to take very direct action, but at the same time, he wouldn't quite admit that there were still moral compromises in doing that. Well, I think that's the first thing, is that can we really make that distinction? And is there really any kind of active action that is morally pure. And I guess I'm really raising the question whether there is. Secondly, I don't think that actions, violent actions for social change, are what introduces the violence into the situation. The violence is already there. Whether that's in direct violence like the essentially massacre of 700 people in Soweto 12 years ago, or in more structural kinds of violence. And I think maybe the best way to express that is to read a quote from a peasant in El Salvador. "I worked on the hacienda over there and would have to feed the dogs bowls of meat or bowls of milk every morning, and I could never put those on the table of my own children. When my children were ill, they died with a nod of sympathy from the landlord. But when those dogs were ill, I took them to the veterinarian in Suchitoto, I guess it is. You will never understand violence or nonviolence until you understand the violence to the spirit that happens from watching your children die of malnutrition." I think sometimes we can argue that violent revolution or violent act is really an act of self-defense. I think that's something to be considered. Thirdly, I think that sometimes very absolute positions on nonviolence really don't adequately respond to evil in our world. I really do very, very strongly believe and embrace the power of nonviolence. I really do. I also wonder sometimes if nonviolence would really work against somebody like Somoza in Nicaragua or Hitler in World War II. And I guess the question tonight is, will it really eventually work in South Africa with a government and a people that are that entrenched into the lifestyle they have? Fourthly, I think it's very easy for North Americans, for myself as a North American, to advocate nonviolence. I also believe that my sisters and brothers in the Third World are in a very different situation. And I think that there may be times that I am really called as a Christian out of my faith to act in solidarity with people who have taken up arms. Not that I necessarily, and I'm not sure about this, would necessarily be the one also called to take up arms myself, but at least I should be willing to consider the possibility that people of faith in other parts of the world in different situations than what I know are the ones that probably need to make that decision. And I just want to read a few brief quotes. These are all Latin Americans because that's the area of the world that I'm most familiar with, but I think the situation still applies. First comes from Miguel Descoto, who is a priest and also the foreign minister of Nicaragua. And this is sort of an imagined dialogue between Desmond Tutu and Descoto, which I would invite anybody to read. It comes out of the Christian Century last year. But Descoto replies to supposed statement by Tutu, really advocating absolute nonviolence. And Descoto says, "Yes, violence does breed violence, but painful as it was for me, the cause of justice long denied did not present us with the choice between violence and nonviolence. The only choices were Somoza's unjust violence and revolutionary violence for justice. And while we are both devoted to nonviolence in the name of Christ, I think you are now facing the same sort of choice in South Africa." A quote from a liberation theologian, Jose Miguez Menino. "The question of the legitimacy of revolution is not decided on the basis of the legitimacy of violence and vice versa. Violence is a cost that must be estimated and pondered in relation to a particular revolutionary situation. It is relative because in most revolutionary situations, at least those with which we are concerned, violence is already a fact constitutive of the situation. Injustice, slave labor, hunger, exploitation are forms of violence that must be weighed against the cost of revolutionary violence." from Camilo Torres, who was a Colombian priest who tried every form of nonviolence he could and eventually took up arms and was killed as a guerrilla. We do not serve our neighbor by giving him old shoes or leftovers from the table of the rich. We serve our neighbor with a fundamental agrarian reform, with free education, with the reasonable distribution of the riches, with equality of opportunity for everyone. And since these are accomplished only by taking power, then it is necessary to revolt in order to take power. Revolution is not only permitted, but indeed becomes obligatory for Christians who see it as the only ample and effective means of realizing their love for humanity. And finally, from Alex Costa, who is a Brazilian sociologist, I do not opt for violence, it is forced upon me. I have no other choice. If I opt for nonviolence, I'm the accomplice of oppression. I take sides on behalf of the violence of the state. The Christian temptation is to have faith in a naive and ineffective nonviolence. So, just to wrap up, I think that while I see violence as an absolute last resort and only under very, very careful conditions and used with very, very strict principles, and I won't go into the details of that, I really do think that there are times that we're called to, not being a Lutheran around here, one of the few, it's always great when I can quote Luther, that sometimes we're really called to sin boldly, and that there are times that we cannot live in a morally pure world, and that there are times that we have to take risks, that maybe what we're doing isn't exactly right, but that seems to be what we're called to do at that particular moment, and that we as North Americans then have a call to be in solidarity with those people, and that we cannot live in the position that nonviolence is the only justified means of political change, and that sometimes violence is necessary. So I would answer that question with a yes, sometimes.
Am I on? I don't know exactly where on this continuum you thought I was supposed to be.
I think you're with Barry.
I'm with Barry. Thank you very much, Barry.
Say a little bit about the South African
situation. I'll say a few more words.
Situation.
Because I have to speak from that perspective, which is what I know a little bit about. First of all, I would have to say that ever since Martin Luther King came on the scene, he has been, to me, a very heroic figure, and one that I admire very much. And his way of nonviolence, it just seemed to me that's the only way to go. And I think, in at least as far as thinking about war and this whole business of what is a just war, I think I would practically be close to being a pacifist when it comes to that. I want to say a little bit more about that in a minute, but first of all, as far as civil disobedience is concerned, all right, that is often the only channel by which oppressed people are able to share in the process of making laws. And it's in a democratic process. And in South Africa, civil disobedience now becomes a means by which, I would have to say, an illegitimate government is to be removed. Not every government, just because it's there, is legitimate. I think that's one point I would make. Just because it's there doesn't mean it's legitimate. And the next thing then after civil disobedience is going to be revolution against rulers who defy the will of God. This is what it comes to. And before I lived in Namibia, I don't suppose I would have said that. But the people in South Africa and Namibia feel that they have to answer violence with violence, and I don't feel that I am in a position to contradict them. They know their situation. Even as far back as 1962, Nelson Mandela said that the white government has resorted to violence and thus is inviting violence. And the time comes, he said, when one has to choose, you either submit or fight. That's Nelson Mandela. Well, he spent years and years in Robben Island, in the prison island in South Africa. So then there's a question. Should the oppressed resort to violence? The state's failure to deal rightly with the people is an invitation to revolution. And they are inviting it in South Africa. I have to say that. They have criminalized any kind of peaceful protest. They've made a criminal offense out of anything peaceful. They banned the African National Congress. And they banned, some years, about 1966, they banned also SWAPO, the political party committee. Those two parties, up until that time, were peaceful parties. And as soon as they were banned, they immediately formed a military arm. The South Africans simply forced them into that. They have the so-called security laws. They have the 90 days detention act. And then they have the 180 days detention act. And then they have an act by which a person can be detained, that is arrested, imprisoned, in order to prevent an act against the government. Well, there's no end to this. In 1 year, they detained 30,000 people. And up to 40% of the people detained are children under the age of 18. This is violence. Aside from the economic violence and the psychological violence that these people have been suffering already for many years, there's these things. And it seems as though revolution is going to come as a response to this tyranny. I'm thinking of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who decided, and he didn't decide this lightly at all, he decided that he had to make this choice, a choice between what is bad or what is worse. And he figured those are the only alternatives, so he chose what is bad, not instead of what is worse, and joined in the plot to assassinate Hitler. Of course, it was the death of him, but I do believe that there is a difference between a just war and a just revolution, or a just war theory and a just revolutionary theory. And you can put it like this: a just war theory, as a written statement, let's say, is written from the perspective of the ruling class. And a just revolutionary theory is written from the perspective of the oppressed, of the common people. That's quite different. So I guess I'm saying that the other option to revolutionary violence is the democratic process, and that doesn't seem to be working in Southern Africa.
So you would say that nonviolence can't, there are certain situations where nonviolent action will not work because the tyranny is so subtle and so pervasive.
That
nonviolence no longer can, it's nonviolence is simply complicity with the regime because the regime has so blocked.
Right. It isn't even left to them anymore as an option. Mm-hmm. They can't even do it anymore.
So is there anybody here who can make a better defense or has a way that they could propose a nonviolent theory that would work in a place like Southern Africa or in other places of tyranny, or do we all agree with that option that basically when tyranny takes over you need to have some kind of revolution in order to restore justice?
I just want to shift one other focus here.
Okay.
In other words, I think as church people, we must focus on our participation in violence. And we must begin to think about how institutionally we practice nonviolence. The United States government has trained Guatemalan police, Salvadoran police, in torture methods. We have provided to South Africa complicated computer systems whereby they keep their surveillance thing. The CIA is involved in destabilization of involved in about 37 operations around the world. Now, I'm not saying right now that we, in fact, I think right now we should practice nonviolence against the United States government. And we should protest nonviolently. And that's why I hear you say we should engage in civil disobedience, we should form ways of resistance, and that's where we should focus. I'm not saying that the time might not ever come in the United States where I would go further than that. But I think in other countries where they are resisting oppressive governments that our government has aided, we do not have the right to say to them that they must, or that they ought to practice nonviolence. I think we ought to express some kind of solidarity with them, even though we may not like to want to participate directly in their armed struggle.
So you're saying that nonviolence in our country could have an incredibly important effect upon the situation in their countries, which now requires violence. But if we would change some of our policies in this country by our own churches, speak as people who believe in God, churches or a personal response that to these situations.
I think we have opportunities in our country to practice nonviolence and against our participation.
In fact, Latin Americans have said that to us. They said your refusal to practice your legal fairly easy nonviolent actions in your own country force violence upon us. That's our only recourse. You have the opportunity, and you don't take it, and because you don't take it, we have no choices.
There's also a way in which we use a sort of ploy of the demand for nonviolence as a really is almost a weapon for maintaining the status quo of violence. In other words, in South Africa, the United States government says we will not support any of this unless it's nonviolent, and yet at the same time, the very same people are sending millions of dollars to force a violent revolution in Central America. Church people do the same thing. I mean, I've heard people say, you know, I have an absolute line on nonviolence in Southern Africa, and yet at the same time be supportive of Contra Aid. That makes no sense to me whatsoever. But it's a use of a term and a theory as a weapon.
One of the problems with that comes out in who decides which is the just and which is the unjust. You know, who decides whether it's right to send aid to the Contras versus sending aid to revolution in South Africa?
That's a tough
question.
Yeah, sure.
Are there examples in the world where strictly nonviolent action without either violence or at least a threat of violence has really accomplished a major revolutionary change? We talked about this earlier in the day. As much good as Martin Luther King did, I still think that as far as the white consciousness in our country toward civil rights for blacks mainly came from violence. That really forced the issue with the situation in Watts and the threat of white blood being spilled is what really ensured civil rights, and I think continues to ensure it. I think that the white people in our country still still have a healthy respect for the possibility of violence on the part of blacks. And you can feel that when you're in a city where there's a lot of blacks. You respect them because of that tension. It ensures, it's an anti-racism kind of thing. I think it ensures their security in our country.
So it's
I hate to say that weapons are a deterrent, yeah. But I think there's a healthy respect there that keeps racism at bay.
Well, that's an interesting counter view. I mean, most people would say that it was the nonviolence that won the rights victory. Does anybody hold that view?
I was thinking that if there is an example, it might be Gandhi in India, although I'm not well enough acquainted with whether there was violence there, but he was a peaceful resistor and it brought the end of the Raj, of the British rule in India. He was totally a nonviolent person in his actions.
There was violence though, and there was a very
real. I know, that's why I say violence. I don't know how much that was necessary to bring about this conclusion. I don't know.
So it's nonviolence. It's a nonviolent tactic that you hold up, but there's behind that the real threat that everything's going to break loose. Clearly, when Gandhi was fasting to death, I mean, if he had died, bad things would have happened, right?
Yeah.
Those of you who know that history, I don't know it that well, but I think that's true.
I mean, part of what goes on with the South African government interfacing with Soweto is the realization of the South African army that they're not going to encounter any real violence. They may have some rocks thrown at them, but they're not going to have any real violence. I think there was a threat of real violence there. It would change their tactics.
I think some of the voices that speak out very loud and clear today, though, are the nonviolent ones. Bishop Tutu and Oscar Romero. Now, both of those gentlemen, if both of them would have bore arms, if Romero would have took a gun, he would never be have the influence on the people today and on nonviolence that he has. In the same way with Tutu.
So there's a moral. You're saying there's a moral authority behind nonviolence that isn't there behind violence. Do other
that's
people
right.
agree with that? I mean, do we respect warriors as much as we respect?
How do you think the civil rights movement would have turned out if their king wouldn't have been around, or what had happened in India? Gandhi wouldn't have been there. I mean, it's sort of an if question, but
you're saying that there'd be there would have been more violence.
Well, what would have been the outcome? Would we,
Can you answer your question? I mean, what's your thinking?
Oh, okay. Well, I'm saying that the possibility of I really don't think as much good could have come out of it if it would have been solely a violent hand as opposed to. I think we really moved a lot more people. Sort of the more. Common people, I mean, just your average church community can get behind something like that, whereas, to come in with Malcolm X and say that, we've got to change it.
Well, right before it came up here, I read the Pulitzer Prize winning biography of King, Bearing the Cross, which I would recommend to people. One of King's, the thing that King was always aware of, King was a very real pragmatist, and he was quite aware that, and he would say constantly, we're outnumbered. There are more of them than there are of us. We cannot take up arms because we'll all be killed. So this is the only tactic, it's sort of reversing what you said, David, was the only tactic that was available. The only way that social change could be, and it could be brought to the consciousness of the nation, that constant grinding moral presence that finally wore some things down. Though I also agree with you that there was also that fear of violence in the background. But King, straight out, in most of his letters and all of his conversations with people, just said, you know, he didn't constantly sort of be this saintly character that we've sort of mythologized him in. He was straight out on the numbers question here. There's more of them, and there are of us, they got more money, they got more power. This is the only thing that's that we can do, so we gotta do it.
Yeah, Jim. Just in terms of, it seems to me, just in terms of understanding how it is that social change happens, at least in the 20th century, the most persuasive arguments that I know about are neither an either-or kind of argument, but an argument that says, look, basically, what we've got is a series of power struggles, all in different historical contexts, and that there are different elements that make up the power. There's always force, and most often that takes violence. It takes some kind of violent form at some point. But those moments of change that have a tinge of morality about it seems to me, and therefore are interesting from a Christian perspective, right? And that really do carry a kind of justice aura about them, almost always have at least a segment, you know, speaking for what is a good society. Mm-hmm. What is a moral society? How should human beings act together? Holding up a vision and usually attaching some kind of strategy and tactics, mm-hmm. nonviolent strategy and tactics to that. Often not separated, you know, from the overall dynamic that's going on that has a much more powerful, violent mm-hmm. thing to it. So mm-hmm. I guess I would argue, at least in our understanding, that we ought to put these things together. That doesn't answer where we should be ourselves about that. But that you seldom get a situation that's either or.
Can you give us an example? Tell us an example.
Well, I think both the king and the Gandhi examples are on Bob's end of the spectrum. I mean, there was you know, clearly it seems to me are examples of struggles that had a large dimension of morality mm-hmm. for various reasons. Mm-hmm. Some of them tactical and strategic, as Susan was saying, right? Mm-hmm. That they would work. You know, Gandhi was not a non-pragmatist either. Mm-hmm. He knew what would work. Mm-hmm. But both also had very much the threat of force, mm-hmm. The threat of violence, the threat of upheaval, the threat of making things, you know. So it could be that Tutu will be listened to more in South Africa when the ANC guerrillas begin guerrilla activities more visibly in the white areas, mm-hmm. which they haven't done much of yet. Seems to me that'll be the next stage of escalation of violence in South Africa. And then to have the dynamic of increased violence and a kind of moral tone and an option for people who want to talk about where to go.
Why didn't the moral tone work with the Sandinista revolution in America? Is it just because we didn't find out about these people and their ideals and their hopes? Is it that we rejected it because it was inviolent? It's sort of encased in this violent revolution? Is it because we had many economic things at stake?
I think the Sandinistas, I mean, John can answer this, the Sandinistas are more like the Cubans. I mean, we applauded, most of us applauded, most of the United States applauded Castro. Mm-hmm. Thought this was a terrific thing. Most of the United States applauded the overthrow of Somoza. Thought that was a terrific thing. Then gradually the interests that saw another set of threats emerging consolidated their forces, but it took a while. I mean, you know, lots of major actors in the United States were on the side of both Castro mm-hmm. and the Sandinistas at the beginning of their revolution. Only later did we sort of slot them as evil mm-hmm. Soviet bloc communist states.
I guess I just want to, some things you're talking about, Tutu. I mean, I have not been to South Africa, but from talking to people who are from there and from people who've been there, there's a lot. We see Tutu as the great beloved of every black in South Africa, and from what I understand, there's a lot of disenchantment with Tutu because he will not take certain actions that people want, and that he is too passive. And I know that there's great conflict between, say, he and Alan Bosack. Very often they work together, and they try to work those out. I guess there's not even that clarity there. I agree with you. I don't, in terms of the civil rights movement. I guess I don't want to
I don't like being seen as a person who's advocating violence here. There's a real difference between advocating violence and being willing to take the risk of a morally impure position. And of saying that maybe there isn't a morally pure position in this case, and that what I'm really called and a faithful position to do is this. And I really think that, I think there is a moral advantage to nonviolence. I really believe that. In the perception of other people and the way that affects how we enter a situation, how that affects other people that we are opposed to, and I, by all means, if that is possible, I think that everyone is better off. But I guess I'm also saying that I think that sometimes we are complicit in the problem by taking a strictly nonviolent position. I guess is what I'm trying to make that distinction. It's not just a matter of saying we should just run in on every situation and be violent.
Sherry's had her hand up.
Yeah, I think though that there's a distinction between being passive and being nonviolent. And the only way that nonviolence can work is if we are as active in our nonviolence as the people that are taking up arms are as active in their violence. And I think that it can work if we do band together and if we are truly active and if we do take all the risks that those people out there shooting each other are taking. And I think we can make great gains if we go to that lane.
Plus, what John was saying behind me here is that we in America taking nonviolent risks can, and you were saying that too, can change things in a very powerful way, so that the world situation will become much changed.
Well, I think just one.
I'll just follow. We're using these words and we're not really defining very much, but I think Barry did allude to a little bit before. When does it really become violent? When does an action become a violent action? Now you take the SWAPO people, the Klan people in Namibia, they engage in certain acts of sabotage, and they are very careful to do these things so that people will not be hurt.
SWAPO is the good guys, by the way. In case people don't know.
Right. Okay. Yeah, they're the people who are the party going against apartheid in Namibia, and. They're like it'll be against the military installation or in a post office in the middle of the night when no one's in there, those kind of things. In return, the South African Army comes with their kind of bomb. They'll plant a bomb in the, let's say, in the Oshakati bank at a time when there's going to be a lot of black people in there, and they quietly let the white folks know, do your banking on the previous day. And after the bomb goes off, they stand guards around there and don't let people come in to help the injured and the dying that are in there. Now that's really, that's vicious violence. Mm-hmm.
Do they then blame it on SWAPO?
Oh yeah,
okay.
Oh yeah.
Just wanted to get that.
They do that, and then they say, well, it's SWAPO who did it, obviously, yeah, they did. But SWAPO doesn't operate that way. Thank you.
That's helpful.
Sorry,
so the degrees of violence and heinous violence. I mean, the ovens in World War II is different from other things that happened.
Right.
Nuclear bombs in World War II were pretty bad.
I just want to follow up on Sherry's point about being aggressive, assertive, nonviolent. And I think a Witness for Peace, going down and the impact of having 3,000-5,000 people go down to Nicaragua. The Pledge of Resistance, the Sanctuary Movement. And I think a lot of the churches could do a lot more in those areas than we have done, which means develop a strategy of nonviolence that enters into this institutional world of violence and takes some risks and lifts up some kind of vision of understanding. In the presence of conflict, if we're willing to do that, then I can begin to see a church's role as holding up nonviolence.
Mm-hmm.
But to sit and talk that other people shouldn't fight back.
Or should fight back.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a cost to them that that we're not willing to take. Yeah. We're not willing to do nonviolent action.
Well, Barry touched on it a while back. I think that, you know, I think we'd be naive to think that one medicine is going to work for all ills. And I think that we have to look at each individual situation and to see if a nonviolent application would work. In addition, I think that when we're talking about nonviolence, I think it is a mistake to show your hand. I used to play some poker, and I think that you don't show your final card too early, or in negotiations. And I think that once you state the fact that we'll only go so far and not a step beyond, many governments can use that position and know exactly how far you are going to go and when you're going to fold.
Can I ask the pragmatic question that we were sort of talking about, the pragmatic concerns that Martin Luther King had? And one of my thoughts has been, in looking at what the situation is in South Africa, in the systematic isolating of blacks in areas where violence on them will not affect white people, and in the lack of accessibility to weapons and things like that. But even though the numbers are greatly different, what is the pragmatic result of violence in South Africa, would you say?
I don't know, because the ruling power in South Africa has got all the firepower. The only thing that is against them is vast numbers. But I think, I don't know, I think finally just the vast numbers are going to win. But more than that, I would not know how to answer that. Hmm. Okay. I just saw this cartoon that's on the board back there. Take a look at it.
I think there's two situations where violence is certainly called for, justified. One is the bread and butter issues. You have starvation and hunger, then the only answer there to me is violence. And we've seen violence in our own labor movement in this country. And in the 30s, we saw violence with peaceful farmers, with shotguns turning over milk in this country. And we were close to revolution in this country in the 30s. Hmm. And the other thing is this political oppressive bit. And we saw that in Hungary, and certainly justified. Now I think the same thing is going to happen in South Africa, and just a question of time.
Well, I think I'd like to bring us back to what John said, though, that is it possible that we ourselves are willing to take some of these risks? And the risk to us is very small. The risk would be to have your husband, who's a police chief, be ridiculed because you, his wife, are taking a stand, or some small gesture for us could result in someone getting out of prison in another country. Do these kinds of risks seem like risks that you're willing to take?
One response I have to that is that it occurs to me that we have such an incredibly huge array of possible activities that are even short of risk-taking.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Kate, I admire you terrifically for being sentenced to hold them. But it does seem to me that, I mean, we are in election year, for instance, and here in a Lutheran, predominantly Lutheran crowd, at least some of the time, we have to fight our own kind of inclination toward privatism, our own inclination not even to be involved in the acceptable ways, the non-risk-taking ways, to change government, to change policies. And there is so much to be done that has nothing to do with risk.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that the example of civil disobedience is marvelous and often needed in the United States, but there is so much to be done short of that for all of us.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I think in your opening statement, you said something sort of belittling letter writing. And I think letter writing can be a very powerful tool. It has been for a long time.
Amnesty International certainly uses it very effectively. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, we have that opportunity for us to do that tonight. Mm-hmm. And, you know, perhaps we can make an impact if everyone in the village wrote a letter, or half of us, or the people here did.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's something you can do that really is not that big a risk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. I wasn't intending to do that. We'll go back to the tape and see if I can. Is there anything?
Well, I just wanted to answer a question in another way too, is to say that, and I think Barry said it best this evening, that not only should we be willing to take risks, civil disobedience, or to do work, or to sweat a little bit, or to knock on doors, or to raise money, but that we are, and I can't believe that here I am, the Catholic girl, or the ex-Catholic from Chicago, using words like call to do so. I always think of a telephone when I hear that word. If anything we're about, that is a must, I should hope.
Yeah.
It's not willing or do I have the time. It's like, hey, look in the mirror.
Exactly, and that's one of the wonderful things about Holiness, that we have someone like David and Lois who are here, who bring the passion so that we can experience the passion, mm-hmm. like John, who have been in places, many of you have been in these places and have experienced the passion. When we feel that is definitely... that is a call, you know? We are here, it is happening to us, we see the film, it suddenly clicks inside of us. We are called by that coming together of experiences. We are called to do something about a response and try to be faithful to that. That's what God is calling us to do. I mean, that's God who weeps when the children are killed is reaching out to us with the Spirit and saying, it's yours now. You know, you understand what I'm feeling. Now take it and do something with it.
I felt called tonight when Lorna, someone from Namibia, read the song.
Mm.
I mean, that's...
Exactly.
That's not my situation, but I feel called when she reads something like that.
Mm-hmm. It's a real gift that we have here. And to treasure that as God's touching us and to take that from His place.
I just don't think we can ever underestimate the repercussions that some actions can take. If that was just numbers and numbers and numbers, it's it has spun people's heads around. I know that
actions and prayers too. Prayers, you know.